Hello, everybody. This is Jace from the Comic Source Podcast, and I have someone here who wants to share a very special message with all you listeners.
Hi, everybody. This is Kelly Dale. If you don't know me, you might have heard a previous podcast that I did with Jace, and we talked about the Jeremy Dale Skyward Omnibus. Well, I just want to get a heads up to everyone, all the fans out there. The omnibus itself, the Kickstarter went well. We are completely funded. So yay, this means the omnibus is actually going to happen. Now, if you happen to miss out on the Kickstarter and you still want an omnibus, there will be a handful still available. So just send me an email, let me know. I will be at Heroes Con, which is in June in Charlotte, with the omnibuses. So if you have, already backed it and want to pick it up there, or if you would like to be there and pick one up, then I'll definitely be there. I'm also going to be at Dragon Con here in Atlanta over Labor Day weekend. And again, I still may have a few omnibuses left. So thank you everyone for all of your support. It's amazing. The omnibus itself is going to the printers on Monday and it's all going well. So thank you.
All right, listeners, I want to extend my thank you as well. I can't really remember supporting a Kickstarter, being involved with a Kickstarter that went so well. 5 stretch goals. It really exceeded my expectations. And I'm so happy for Kelly and that Jeremy's work is still going to be out there inspiring people, making people smile for you to all enjoy it. So I add my thanks to Kelly's. And if you have any questions, you can email Kelly. Go back and listen to the previous podcast. We promoted it on the Comic Source for quite a while. So all the details are there. I'll also put the details in the show notes for this episode. So if you want to contact Kelly, have any questions, the details will all be there. So thanks for coming on, Kelly, and giving everyone an update.
No problem. Thanks for having me back. And again, thank you to everyone.
Yep, definitely. Okay, everybody, take care.
Bye.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. It's time for another Valiant Sunday, and this time, Jesse and I are going to be talking about Eternity. So, welcome to the show, Jesse. Thanks for joining me, as always.
Anytime, big guy. I like it here.
So, Eternity. Trade paperback comes out this Wednesday, I believe, April 4th, I think it is. So just to give a quick rundown on the creative team, just like the Divinity series of miniseries that came out before this and are kind of a prelude to this, same characters introduced us to these characters. They're all written by Matt Kent. They all come from his fertile imagination. The pencils are by Trevor Hairsine. The inks are by Ryan Wynn. The colors are by David Barron. And much like all the Valiant comics, there are a lot of different covers, but I specifically want to mention the main covers by Jelena Kevick-Jurjevich. They are incredible. They are so amazing. They're painted. They're like a matte finish. It's very much a thicker cardstock, a thicker paper that most of the comics that Valiant puts out. So you're really getting a really quality product. And man, I just... Every one of the covers is stunningly beautiful, so I wanted to make sure to mention that. So, for those of you not familiar with the property, as I said, Eternity was a 4-issue series, but there were actually 2 previous series. The main character, whose name Divinity, he's introduced to us in the first Divinity 4-issue miniseries, and then there was a follow-up to that, Divinity 2, which had several other tie-ins as well. And I'm going to let Jesse talk about Divinity 2, but I'm going to just give you a real quick recap of the first 4-issue Divinity series. We meet Abram Adams. He's an African-American, but he's grows up in Russia. He's basically found as a baby on the doorstep of a house, and he early on shows maybe some awkward social skills. He's very much an introvert and likes to lose himself in books, but he's also extremely intelligent. And based on this early fascination he has with science fiction and this scientific aptitude he shows, he enters this top secret program. You know, this is set during the Cold War. And the Soviets not only want to win the space race, they want to push the envelope. They're not interested in just getting to outer space or getting to the moon. They want to explore the furthest reaches of the galaxy. So through this experimental program, they send some cosmonauts out to basically the edge of the galaxy. And Abram Adams encounters a power there. He's granted power from, we don't know who at the time, in this place called the Unknown. So the first 4-issue Divinity series is both that story told in flashback, as well as the story of Divinity's return to Earth decades later. And he seems to have these omnipotent godlike powers. And so the first 4-issue miniseries kind of explores him returning and trying to find his place in the world. And like, what do you do when somebody returns, somebody who used to be human returns and they have these godlike powers? You know, how do you stop them? Do you stop them? Because the powers that be at Unity, the Unity superhero team, is sent out to stop him because the powers that be see him as a threat. Not because he overtly does anything threatening, but just because that much power in the hands of someone who's not controlled by, you know, world governments or these, you know, world leaders, it makes them nervous, right? So that's kind of the first 4-issue series. We see Abram Adams, Divinity, come back to Earth. We learn his origin in the flashback, and we really see I won't say he judges humanity, but he observes it. You know, he's thinking a lot about what he left behind. You know, he left behind a woman that he loved very much and a child. And so it's about him trying to reconnect with those people. And it's a very thought-provoking story. I'll put it that way. And I'll let Jesse tell you guys all about Divinity 2, which was a much deeper dive, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely, big guy. So, like you said, in Divinity 1, there's a couple things here. I'm gonna hit in a couple points. The first is what you mentioned about Yelena's cover art. Yelena is a mainstay throughout the entire series, all the series. She, made the regular cover for each of the first 4 issues. Then she made the regular cover for each of Divinity 2. She made the regular cover for each of Divinity 3, the Stalinverse. And she made the regular covers for Eternity. So she is she's a consistent creative talent attached to the entire mythos of Divinity. And also talking about the creative team involved, we have Matt Kent, who has written every single issue start to finish for each inception of this. Trevor Hairsing, Brian Wynn, David Barron, they've done every single issue, the artwork for the interior pages for every single issue, except for Divinity Zero, which was a different creative artist in that. But so when you're reading Eternity or when you're reading Divinity 2 or whatever the case may be, each issue has the same style. It has the same feel. So it's got a very familiar feel as you go through it. So if it was ever to be this just gigantic book, it would for the most part maintain that theme start to finish. Now Divinity 2. All right. So rewinding slightly, in Divinity issue number 3, the very first series that was just discussed, you're introduced to not just Abram, but also Mishka and Kazmir, which were the three of which were cosmonauts. That were sent out into the unknown far reaches of space during the Russian exploration of space. Of course, we followed along what happens to Divinity himself, but it's not until Divinity 2 that we discuss Mishka and Kazmir and what their disposition was. And they end up exploring worlds and being marooned on alien planets and going through a lot of a very different chain of events than Divinity himself did. Eventually, Mishka, sacrifices in a sense her colleague and returns to Earth. And while Divinity himself had a was grounded in compassion and science fiction and kind of had hope for the future, Mishka was very, very happy being a mechanism of the state. She was very, very very Russian, very, very pro-Mother Russia. And so when she returned to Earth with godlike powers, she sees, she knows what to do with these talents. Instead of searching to find her own humanity, she uses them as a tool to serve Mother Russia. She wants to, you know, make Russia into the, empire that in her mind it always should have been. And so, inevitably she goes and has to battle divinity. They go toe to toe. They have the exact same powers. It's just a matter of how do they use those powers in battle. She's far more vicious, far more deadly in battle because she's, you know, much more, unforgiving as a person. Whereas divinity doesn't try to rip people to shreds or obliterate their existence. He tries to, you know, alter their mind, and or alter, their perception of time, or he tries to give them what they want, or he does a lot of things passively. It's a very, very passive, very, very, cerebral, approach to combat. Whereas Mishka, you know, she'll you shoot laser blasts out of her hands or just vaporize a human being or whatnot. Just very, very, vicious and volatile. And over the course of time, of Divinity 2, you see how their combat, their interactions, you know, start transcending time and dimension and space, and to a point where Divinity himself is able to plant the seeds of hope and kindness in Mishka at a very young age, which he defeats her in the past, which therefore defeats her in the future. He defeats her by making reminding her of her own humanity and love, in which case, where we finish off with Divinity 2, they are actually, you know, moving forward together in this world as two gods looking to, tackle the future. This leads into Divinity 3, in which case, the Stalinverse, which is the return of Kazimir, who is the third of the cosmonauts. And he is by far the most unstable and destructive of the three. And so he actually changes and alters reality and time and space and rewrites the history of the world over the last 100 years or so, to where Russia is the dominant force in this world. It conquers the world. There's little rebel groups and whatnot, you know, and whatnot. But, for the most part, he creates a red world, kind of like, Red Sun, you know, where Superman had come to Earth and was, you know, instead of landing in the Midwest, he landed in Russia. And so he served the Russian people. It's kind of like that. What's interesting about Divinity 3 is that they also include a series of characters, called the Red Brigade. There's Red Legend and Costly the Deathless and a number of other characters that are, over the next few years, we hope. Are going to be very, very strong, pivotal characters. You're going to see them in Ninjak and various other areas. But anyway, Divinity 3, the same thing. You know, they go through these breaking through what Kazimir's Russian New World is. They destroy the illusion at the end of it all. Divinity and Mishka are together as a couple. Oddly enough, the characters, Red Legend and Costly of the Deathless and whatnot, they continue on, even though they were created as an illusion. Somehow they live through that and continue on. And it sets up, the events of Divinity Zero, which is kind of like an intermission between between the three Divinity chapters and, what will become Eternity, where we see Mishka and Divinity living together, happily, you know, they're visiting all the characters. They're making sure Ninjak is okay. They're coming and talking to Toyo Harada. They're making sure he's okay. And towards the end, after the world looks to be in peace, after the world looks to be all correct, Mishka rolls over to her now lover, Divinity, and says, "I'm pregnant," which that's where Divinity Zero ends. And Divinity, which I would say might as well be called Eternity Zero, that is where it starts. At the moment where, you know, everything that Divinity knows, everything that Mishka knows, is about to change. They're about to bring life into the world, two gods giving birth to one child. And that's where the issue ends. And then several months later, Eternity One was released. And I think that's a good recap of that series.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for that, Jesse. So, You know, I've gone back and forth. How much do we want to, you know, give away here? I think a lot of you probably have read Eternity, but at the same time, there's probably some of you out there who haven't and are planning to pick it up in trade when it comes out this week, as I said. So I think we're actually going to go not necessarily, you know, story beat by story beat, but we are going to get into a lot of the themes, and we are going to I'm about to recap the story here. So my suggestion is if you haven't read it and you plan on picking it up and don't want it spoiled, you probably want to come back to this this later after you've already read it. So of course we want you to listen, but at the same time, you know, we want you to discover the joy of the story on your own. So just to give a broad recap of the Eternity story, you know, Jesse had mentioned that Eternity and, or rather, Divinity and Mishka are having a child, and this story starts out with them enjoying that child. The child seems to be growing up. They seem to be happy, living a simple life in Russia, but it's not meant to last, and the child is actually taken by forces that exist within the unknown. So they, and it almost seems like the unknown, that edge of the galaxy, that place where Divinity and Mishka got their powers, is not really in our universe. That's what we discover through this, because the child is kidnapped. And when Divinity uses his powers to search the entire universe, he says himself, our child's not in this universe. He's missing. And they go on a search to recover the child. And that's an incredible sequence by Trevor Hairsine, because you see, you know, a close up on their little cabin in Russia, and then it pulls out, and he's like searching the earth, and it pulls out, and he's searching the solar system, and it pulls out, and he's searching the entire universe. And so it's incredibly well done. I mean, the art in the series from start to finish is really great. So as Mishka and Abram Adams Divinity go searching for their child, it's very much a trip back into the unknown where they came from and meeting the inhabitants of the unknown. And it's a very interesting series from Matt Kent, because, you know, as I said, I could go story beat by story beat and tell you all the events and everything. But what I found in reading it is, while it's a visual treat, it's not necessarily the story on top that really matters, if you know what I mean. It's not the actual events and actions that the characters are taking, both Divinity and Mishka and these inhabitants of the unknown. To me, that's not where the story is. The story is the underneath layer, with all the themes and all these ideas that Matt Kent is putting forward. And in a way, it's almost meta, because throughout the course of the story, what Divinity himself learns and kind of rediscovers about himself is that it isn't about our differences. It isn't about us as humanity. It's more about ideas and the power of ideas and the way ideas can unify us. So the child is taken, and as I said, Mishka and Divinity go to rescue the child. And through the course of doing that, they meet various characters that are like stepping stones that get them one step closer to finding out where their child is. But in the end, they find out that their child was never really what they thought it was. And it ends up being kind of a cyclical story in a way. And you could see the process continuing as it ends. So hopefully that wasn't too spoilery. Again, I think that if you did decide to stay and you haven't read it, that you're still going to get a lot more out of it having read it yourself. But we are going to talk a little more about the big ideas here in a minute. But well, first let me ask you, Jesse, do you have anything to add to that without getting too spoiler heavy?
No, I'm gonna let us go into our next stage here. I will say this: it was pretty interesting reading through Eternity to start seeing how exactly it does have that cyclical return, because it does go back to different points throughout the previous series of Divinity 1, Divinity 2, which I thought was incredible, because it makes you say, "Oh my God, this happened! Oh yeah, I remember that! Oh, that's what was going on." And so it essentially shows that Matt Kent had planted the seeds of events that would come years later, which it did take several years. Divinity was released in 2015, beginning of 2015. So he's had this whole thing mapped out all along the way. You know, I mean, it may have had some adjustments and morphing along the way, but I mean, Eternity is very, very much interwoven within the fabric of the Divinity series. And you see that throughout the Eternity series, you know. And of course, it makes sense because as we see throughout the Divinity and Eternity series, time is not absolute. Time is a loop. Time is, you know, is a written page that is unwritten, waiting to be written.
Yeah, and Matt Kent very often works like that. You know, as Jesse mentioned, the seeds were planted, pun intended, I suppose. But yeah, if you go look at his mind management series, it's the same way. You get so much out of it. Like you can read it over and over and still catch little Easter eggs. So yeah, it's incredible the way that guy's mind works. Let's talk a little bit about the setting of the unknown. I mean, it is out there. Speaking of Matt Kent's mind, it is visually, I have to give it to Trevor Harrison. I wonder how much him and Matt collaborated back and forth with. I mean, there's like temples and platforms, and they're being held up by giant hands. And it's just such an interesting place visually that it's, again, it's the surface story where you can get lost in the visuals. And you can pay attention to what's going on as far as like the what the characters are doing, the action of the story. But there's so much there to explore visually, and there's the, you know, the themes that go underneath. And I think that the way that they set things up with the different visuals, with the different kind of tribes and peoples of the unknown, that it's an incredible setting. And I think that you could almost launch 3 or 4 titles set in the unknown about these different races or different, you know, sets of beings and explore them for years. What do you think, Jesse?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost like, you know how the Marvel universe is. I mean, you've got Spider-Man and New York and whatnot, and then you have the X-Men all over the place. But then you have like the Inhumans out on the moon, you know, and then you have this celestial and meta kind of thing with Galactus and the Silver Surfer. And so there are parts of the Marvel universe where it's just, you know, just vast stretches of the galaxy, you know, the Guardians of the Galaxy kind of worlds and whatnot. And the same thing has been built here with the Valiant universe, multiple dimensions, different worlds, different races, different characters. I mean, my God, the Eternity series issues 1 through 4. I don't think a single issue of that series came and went without introducing at least 5 or 6 new characters. I mean, they just, with the Eternity series, they just introduced a good 30 characters easily. And, all of these characters, well, not all of them, but, several of them for certain, could easily be popping up all over the Valiant universe at one time or another. Exo Manowar could run into them in space. They could, you know, teleport to Earth and run around with Savage. They could, who knows, you know, but the visuals are what's incredible here is what you're saying. And I will say this. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you say, all right, Trevor, here's what you're going to do. I need you to draw the fifth dimension of a world that defies physics, that exists in time, outside of time, and beyond time, that where gravity is not an issue in a war-torn galaxy that is being reborn. I mean, good luck with that. You pull any artist in and tell them to do that, and you're destined for failure. And Trevor just knocks it out of the park, again and again, issue after issue. It's an incredibly difficult a series to draw because you're drawing concepts, you're drawing ideas, and you're drawing things that are in many ways intangible, and they clearly don't exist in our known universe. So, you know, hats off to this guy. He really, he totally kicks ass with it, and he creates something that just does not appear in the comic book medium very often.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest fan of Trevor. And this is funny because usually I like very, very fine lines, but I almost feel like his lines are a little too fine. And sometimes I feel like his figures and his rendering don't have enough substance. But here's the thing, right? Like if Matt always had this in mind of, okay, I'm going to start with the Divinity story, and it's going to be relatively grounded on Earth and, you know, the Cold War and everything. But it's going to eventually build up to this incredible world that's like out there and psychedelic and crazy ideas. If he knew that and realized that Trevor was going to be perfect for that, and that's why he chose them to illustrate this all along, then kudos, because I can't really imagine anyone else drawing this. Even going back to the first Divinity series, I feel like Trevor's art grew on me as this different series, you know, Divinity 1, 2, and 3 progressed. And not only that, I think his art improved. And it really culminates in his rendering for the Eternity series, because you're right, Jesse. I mean, he completely nails it. He blows it away. These crazy concepts, these interesting races that we have, you know, the Brothers of the Bomb and the Observer and everybody. It's absolutely incredible. And I hope that if we return to the unknown, that Trevor's the only one that ever draws it, because it's really, really incredible. It has to be seen to be appreciated. And you know, this is an audio podcast, obviously. So you're not going to really be able to appreciate it until you see it for yourself. But at least, at the very least, pick up the Eternity trade paperback and flip through it to see exactly what we're talking about.
Right. You know, I'm going to say this. I mean, I'm kind of with you on Trevor's art. There's a lot of art styles. If I had my way, Alex Ross would draw everything, anywhere, at all times. You know, but I mean, that's not possible, because Alex Ross takes, you know, 100,000 years to draw a page. you know, guys like Clayton Henry, who are phenomenally clean artists that are like just incredible and very, very talented. I don't think that they would be the right choice for this kind of a series, because the concepts and setting are so alien, so fantastic in a sense, that a really, really, Clayton Henry's, you know, strong proportions and understanding a perspective just wouldn't work. An artist like Louis LaRosa, who's, you know, almost photorealistic, it wouldn't work for him either, because there is no photorealistic version of this kind of a universe, or this kind of a setting. You really need almost an abstract artist who understands how, you know, to create within the comic book medium to make it happen. And that's where Trevor kind of really shines through, is this is a fantastic science fiction, space epic, meta story. And you know, artist selection, oh my God, artist selection is just so difficult with a story like this, because you don't want an artist to be too perfect, because they won't work. And you can't have a bad artist, because it also won't work. And you know, Trevor's a good artist. He's definitely got a style, and I agree with you on his lines. I mean, it's very, very, I own a couple of his pieces of art, his original art, and you can see it, you know. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, it's rough around the edges, because, you know, that's just his style. I think the series works with it. I think, like, I agree with you. It grew on me. And it got to a point where I really didn't want to see anybody else on the series.
Yeah. I think that having somebody like Clayton on there, it would look, I mean, obviously this is not a real place. This is, you know, fake, but it would look kind of plastic, I think. And I love Clayton Henry's art, but yeah, you're right. I don't think it would necessarily work. And as far as somebody like Louis LaRosa, yeah, his art's great. You know, Miko Suyan's another one. His art's great. But yeah, it does have that sense of photorealism, and there's not any reference for this. So I agree with you 100%. Let's talk a little bit about the colors by David Baron. Man, oh man. David could have gone one of two, or actually a bunch of different directions in this. And I think a lot of color artists would have gone and tried to enhance the mood of the story through some darker colors, you know, a darker palette, and kind of give that sense of like foreboding and menace, cause you're in an alien world. And I think it, telling those kind of stories, that's the direction a lot of color artists go. They go for, you know, more of a gray palette or a muted palette, or, you know, just a lot of dark colors to kind of give that mood almost like a horror story or you know, evoke the mood of like the classic movie Alien, so to speak. David went completely the other way. He went with really bright colors, a lot of light. You can see everything. There's not a lot of shadow. And I think by doing that, he kind of flipped it. You know, you still get the sense of not menace, so to speak, but the sense of importance, the sense of, you know, Divinity and Mishka are looking for their child, and it's you can feel what they feel. You're experiencing what they feel because it is so bright. It is right there in your face on the page because of the palette that David chose. I just don't think that a lot of color artists would have gone that direction. And the other thing it allows Trevor's art to do is it really allows us to see these incredible visuals that Trevor has come up with. You know, I'm sure along with Matt Kent, I'm sure Matt had a lot of input in the way he wanted things to look. And we should also mention that Ryan Wynn, the inker, did a great job. He frequently works with Trevor, and I think their marriage is a good one. Ryan seems to know what Trevor wants to emphasize, and I know Ryan and David Barron are friends as well, so I'm sure they collaborate as far as inks and colors go. So really, from the creative team from the top down, it's an incredible work. And you know, I feel bad. I saw David the last weekend at WonderCon, and I hadn't yet read this, so I didn't get to mention it to him. But the next time I see him, I'm gonna talk to him about the fact that he chose to go the other way, because I'm sure, knowing David, he could talk about it at length, and I'm very interested to kind of get in his head and see why he decided to go with the color palette and kind of the visual painted alien world that he did. What are your thoughts on the colors, Jesse?
So to be honest with you, there's a couple of things. One, I really like the fact that it's a consistent color palette from start to finish. And we're talking from Divinity 1 back in 2015 all the way to Eternity 4. You know, so every single issue, you get the same look, the same feel. You know, there's no, you don't need any variation there, because you want to view this entire thing as one giant book with a series of chapters, because that's what it is. It's a continuing story. It's not, Divinity 1 is connected to Divinity 2, which is connected to Divinity 3, which is connected to Eternity. They're all connected, and they're various chapters of of a larger story. And so that consistency mattered. Now, for me, I mean, I've been reading comic books since the early 80s. It kind of had that feel. Like, I remember reading The Silver Surfer, reading Thor, reading stories in the 80s. That occurred on a galactic level, and it had a similar color palette. I kind of felt like I was being thrown back into retro land, with, you know, giant, strong contrasting greens and purples, and, you know, and very, very vibrant worlds, and, you know, and Cracker jumping out of the sky with his spear and whatnot. And I was like, holy crap, I just got transported back into the 80s. This is awesome. Kudos to you, David Barron, because, you know, first of all, he's a really nice guy. He's very talented. But he really took an interesting take, as you say, on this one, and gave fans something that they haven't seen in a minute, which is a very, very bright retro take on a meta space story.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I hadn't thought about that comparison to the classic Silver Surfer run. Like the Ron Lim art and everything. But yeah, I definitely get that feel. But man, Trevor goes way farther than, you know, not to say that you know, Marvel Silver Surfer series didn't have some kind of weird concepts and everything. But man, this is that on mushrooms, you know. I mean, the visuals here, I just keep going back to, I don't know where the heck these guys came up with the idea to have these, like, everything about it, you know, the little pods, the seeds, the way the different aliens look, Dr. Tyr, like the little, I don't remember his name, but the little one-eyed guy. It's incredible for sure. Let's shift gears here and let's talk a little bit about David Camp and his followers, which have been dubbed the Eternity, kind of a play on the name of the series itself. Why don't you tell everybody, because I didn't mention him, David Camp, in the recap of the first four issues. Why don't you tell everybody, Jesse, about David Camp and his followers, I guess you'd say his disciples.
Okay, so David Camp first appeared in Divinity Issue 1. He was a kind of an extreme sports kind of enthusiast, just a guy, kind of a, you know, ambiguous, a racially ambiguous dude, out in the outback, very fit, got some dreadlocks, climbing a mountain. You know, he gets to the top of this mountain, and he encounters divinity. Like, holy crap, right? And it creates a situation, you know, where there's now you have Australian military, you know, show up and whatnot. And divinity, he just wants to be left alone at this point, and he alters reality. He turns one of them into like a bird man and turns another one into something else and makes another one vanish. And David Camp, in essence, is touched by a god. And so over the course of the different series, Divinity 1, Divinity 2, Divinity 3, David Camp isn't really focused on. He's in the background, if at all. And we don't really pay attention to him. We're paying attention, of course, to Mishka, Kazmir, Divinity, as they go through it and do whatever they're doing. But David Camp, during this entire time, is essentially, he's been touched. He's been touched by a god. And so in his mind, you know, he has to make sense of this all. He's trying to bring meaning to it. You know, he creates a following. He starts his own cult. He's, you know, talking about, well, what any cult talks about, you know. And it's only later on where he feels somewhat betrayed or forgotten or forsaken by the god, which he ultimately makes changes his mindset and changes the direction of his future and starts going down almost like a villainous path. I would say that David Camp becomes a villain. And we see how this guy that's basically hiking in the mountains at one point has gone all the way to where he is pretty soon to be, if not already, going to be a galactic level player. And that's what we see. So if you've never read Divinity, when you start, you're going to note that this guy who seemingly is not very important is quite important. And I do believe at the end of Divinity Issue Number 1, there's a phrase I don't have in front of me, but it basically goes like this. David Camp, meet Abram Adams, you know? And that is it. That is the introduction to these two characters, which has a lot more significance than I personally expected would ever occur. But yet there it is. So now David Camp has tapped into a knowledge, tapped into the universe as a whole. He is aware of things that no man probably should have ever been aware of. And that places him in a situation where he can really move forward with a lot more confidence and focus than his existence ever otherwise would have presented him.
Yeah, it's interesting. I almost wonder if Matt put him in there as almost a foil for Abram Adams and his concepts of, you know, ideas bringing us together. Because in a way, you know, David Camp's been touched by a god, as you mentioned. He does have some power himself. It seems like he gains even more power throughout the four issues of Eternity here through various machinations that he sets in motion. But he kind of defies the idea that ideas are unify us, right? I mean, I'm not sure at what point, and he, as Jesse mentioned, you know, he's touched by a god and he believes in divinity and he starts following them. You know, it's almost like he's starting a religion and they consider themselves the, you know, the followers of divinity and they feel like they have something to offer the world and they can now see the patterns of the universe. And so, but the problem becomes when David Camp starts to put himself above everybody else. There's an arrogance there, like, okay, I've been touched by a god, I have some power, I can see the way the universe works and the patterns and the way everything fits together, and so that makes me better than everybody else. I have these ideas and that makes me better than everyone else, and I get to dictate to people the way things should work because I can see the patterns. And what's interesting is when Divinity and Mishka go to ask David, that's where they basically start their search for their child. And David's very overjoyed to see them, like, hey, it's great. You're going to go back to the unknown. You know, I see the patterns. I know what's going on in the universe. And he expects to be taken with them. It's like he feels like when Divinity and Mishka show back up, it's basically the time he's always been waiting for because they're going to be like best friends, right? And when Divinity and Mishka, you know, leave him behind, it immediately flips, right? It shows really the failing of him as a character because, you know, he is human despite any power or any God touch he's been given. He still has the failings of humanity. He wants to feel important. He wants to feel involved. And when he's dismissed in his mind, and I don't see it that way. I just see it as Divinity and Mishka focused on wanting to get their child. They're not worried about David Camp's concerns, and perhaps rightly so. And I mean, if my child were to disappear, I wouldn't be worried about somebody who was my fan, you know, wanting to be involved in my life. I'd just be concerned and concentrated and focused on getting my child back. But David doesn't see it that way. He sees it as being dismissed, as being disrespected. And immediately the switch is flipped, right? He goes from being a fan of Divinity to being an enemy. And that, to me, really shows that perhaps David Camp really wasn't the right person to receive this power and these gifts from Divinity in the first place. And it's not like Divinity sought him out. He just happened to be there when Divinity returned to Earth. So it's almost like his true colors are showing up. But at the same time, there's something deeper going on there that I think Kent's going for. And it's kind of a foil, kind of the antithesis of the idea that Divinity has about ideas bringing us together. Because really, David is all about the ideas. He's all about the ideas that are generated by him being able to see the patterns of the universe. And it's not all good. You know, it's not that he has these ideas and he's able to see the patterns and, you know, live at kind of this higher level of it. Because he talks about it in the first issue about how he's got these ideas and he can unify us with these ideas and everything. But in reality, what happens through the course of the story is he's using the ideas and the concepts that, you know, he's able to kind of come up with and see through the looking at the universe and the way things are moving around. And he's using them to really become a villain, as Jesse said. Let's go back to our very well-received Harada episode where Jesse and Manny and I talked about Harada, hero villain. And I had they had a hard time seeing Harada as a villain. They saw him more as a hero. I took the stance that he was a villain with the caveat that even though he's doing the wrong things, he's doing them for the right reasons. Well, here you have David Camp, and I would argue that he's doing the wrong things. And he's doing them for the wrong reasons. It seems like he's doing them because, yes, he wants to promote these ideas that he sees as noble, but he wants to promote them for the benefit of himself because he wants to be seen as someone important. So in the end, the ends don't justify the means. And what happens at the very end of Eternity certainly leaves the door open for David Camp to return as Jesse said, kind of a galactic level threat. So again, got to give credit to Matt Kent for taking, as Jesse mentioned, what seems like a minor character that you don't necessarily pay a lot of attention to in the beginning and really showing this arc, right? And if 10 or 15 years down the line, David Camp is, you know, right up there with Toyo Harada as one of the big bads of the Valiant universe, you would almost be able to go back and look at this these Divinity series and Eternity series as David Camp's story in a way. I don't know if he shows up quite enough throughout the course of all the miniseries to really say that, but it's a fun thing to think about, right? You look at something like the Marvel Universe, for example. You have Doctor Doom, who's this, you know, incredible villain who has, you know, long story arcs and you see his growth, but he's not the only big bad. You know, you have Thanos and you have, others. So I certainly think there's room in the Valiant universe for more than just one main villain, which, you know, right now is most well known is probably Toyo Harada. but perhaps David Camp could rise to that level as well. And I should real quick mention Master Dark too, because I know he's returning and he has potential to be crazy villainous as well. So I think that's enough on David Camp. Any last thoughts on Camp and his followers, Jesse?
Yeah, I'll just say, in a sense, Divinity is a spiritual story. Not spiritual in like a worship story. I mean, he is a god, but, you know, it's told from the perspective of a god. And it's interesting because David Camp is very human. Not that Divinity himself isn't human, but, David Camp in many ways, and I don't know if this was intended, but let's just take it there, can represent organized religion in a sense, where like Buddha himself didn't want to be worshipped, and yet here he is being worshipped, Christ, taught on a mountaintop or on a hillside to, people about, loving one another, and then a couple hundred years later, there's, an entire, Christian empire essentially. And, it's amazing what happens, when humans themselves are injected, or inject their own perception of things or their own understanding of things into the spiritual realm or to the godlike realm, because you end up corrupting it. And that's ultimately what, is happening here is, an example of what has historically happened in our own world, where you have a guy that had the right intentions and he was a zealot and he was very, very, passionate about, his faith and what he believed in. And he just, through just being who he is and his own failings, corrupts it. And that is, in essence, what David Camp is he is a corruption of all that he loved and believed in.
Yeah. I like that comparison that you gave, because really when you think about it, for whatever reason, Abram Adams was the right person to receive the power of divinity. He's always, seemed like a very calm character, for whatever reason, story wise that you want to attribute that to. And I'm sure if David Camp had gone to the edge of the galaxy, that things would not have turned out quite in the same way, for the Valiant universe, because, even with the small amount of power he's granted from divinity, he is still very much a human character, and he doesn't seem to have the centeredness that Abram Adams has. And so I think his humanity is much closer to the surface. He doesn't see life and the galaxy and the universe with the same kind of perspective and respect for everything within that universe that Abram Adams seems to have. And they very much seem to be opposite sides of the same coin. And I look forward to seeing David Camp return. And I think he'll be an incredible foil for Divinity going forward. All right. There are so many themes in this book. I jotted down a quick like eight or nine of them to talk about. And we're going to try to keep it relatively short, because I know we're already starting to get a little long. But again, it's part of the reason this is such a good story, all the way from the beginning of the Divinity tale through eternity. And this is really where I wouldn't say Matt is hitting you over the head with the ideas, but again, like I said in the beginning of the podcast, there's the layer on top, the story that's right there, obvious for you both visually and through the concrete actions of the characters. But really, it's a story of a progression of ideas, where Kent is just dropping these little idea bombs as you're reading it. And as I was reading it, I was like, oh, that's something cool to think about. Oh, that's something cool to think about. And really, almost any one of these ideas, I personally could spend hours thinking about and examining from different angles and looking at it from different perspectives. And to me, that's value in story. And that's what story's all about. When you start telling these concepts and these fantastical stories, because it does say something about who we are as people. And those are the best kind of stories in my mind. So the first thing I'll mention is kind of inevitability. And this goes kind of all the way back to the very last concept we're going to talk about, which is life as a cycle. But inevitability, the sense of destiny, the sense of no matter what you do, everything is already planned out. And you don't necessarily have that much control. It's not necessarily the most overt idea of the themes that Kent explores, but it's definitely there. And I won't say that Kent really takes a position or has any of the characters in the story really take a position on one is good or one is bad. You seem to be pretty even-handedly presented both ideas. And I personally don't know where I stand on that concept, because I feel like that's such an abstract concept, and there's so much there to explore that I think I would have to take a very long time thinking about it, weeks if not months, to really kind of decide for myself which side I would fall on. You know, are our lives inevitable? Is everything already planned out? As it pertains to, you know, the real world that I live in, or as it pertains to the world of Valiant. It's certainly an interesting concept to consider. What are your thoughts on inevitability, Jesse?
You know, I feel like reading Divinity, reading Eternity, by the time I got to the end of it, I got the sense of that I had just read The Matrix, if that makes sense. Was this destined to happen, or was this always going to happen, or was something altered along the way to make it happen, or was it meant, or was time just a loop, or is, time not even exist? Is it just a concept that we, as mortals have given, to understand the universe, based on what we know? I think it was played out very, very well in the pages of Eternity, where they describe, and even where Mishka comes to realize, what has really happened, what has really transpired, what is really at stake here. As a human being, we think of time in a linear process. We don't think of it like Dr. Manhattan does, where, as we saw in Watchmen or read in Watchmen, like it's 1952, I'm falling in love. It's 2010, I'm on Mars. It's 1985. I'm fixing a clock. It's 1997. I'm graduating high school. I mean, it's going through all this stuff, right? Because it's all happening simultaneously. And, it never really answers the question, because I don't know that if it did answer the question, that it would be as thought provoking, that it would be, it would achieve its purpose. And the purpose is to make you think. The purpose is to challenge your beliefs. The purpose is to make you question reality. And because that is what is the component of a great story that makes for a great plot device, and which Matt has clearly created here.
Yeah, and it kind of ties in a little bit into the next theme that I want to touch on, and that's your life viewpoint. So there are several factions in the unknown, two main. One, who are always looking forward toward the future to see what's going to happen. And others that are looking back because they believe that the path of existence is plotted and planned and known through seeing where we've been. And that's an interesting idea as well. And these sides are kind of in conflict because they, ideologically, it's kind of completely diametrically opposed. And so this one, I feel I can understand a little better, or I guess I'm a little more further along the path of making a decision myself. And I would say that neither one is necessarily correct. I think that it's a trap that a lot of us here, in our reality deal with, right? You meet people that, have regret and live with regret daily and are constantly like, oh, I wish I would have done this differently. I wish I would have done that. I don't like where I am in my life, and I feel like I made mistakes or circumstances. It's not my fault, but circumstances led me down this path and I don't like where I am, right? And then you have the dreamer people who always say, I'm going to get here. I'm going to get there. I'm going to grow up and be a movie star. I'm going to do whatever. And they're always looking forward to the point of not paying attention to where they are now. Because again, as I think they're both wrong. I think what you need to do is you need to live in the now. Don't look back because you can't affect the past. Don't look too far forward, because if you look too far forward and you're dreaming, you're never going to do what you need to do in the now to get there. So for me, it's interesting that there are these two diametrically opposed factions. And you have this character, the Observer, who kind of keeps the peace and is really the one character who kind of lives in the now, because he can see the past and the future, but dismisses them for, or rather puts the importance on, I need to do what I need to do now. I need to take action for the now in order to guarantee the future. But the other interesting thing about these two viewpoints, these two life viewpoints that Kent presents us with, is the fact that all throughout this series, as Jesse's mentioned several times, Kent treats time as very fluid. Time's a page, in a book, and you can flip backwards and forwards in a book without trouble. And that's certainly a power that Divinity has. He's able to move through time. So you've got these two sides that are opposed to each other because one's looking future, one's looking past. You've got the Observer in the middle keeping the peace because he's actually in the present. But then you throw in the idea that the reasons that the factions are giving for their belief in one or the other really don't matter to somebody like Divinity, because the past and the future and the present are all the same. He can kind of exist, just like Jesse was saying, Dr. Manhattan, everything exists throughout this time. Not to say everyone in the unknown has that level of power that Divinity has, but it certainly gives more perspective to it. Like, why, again, are you living in the past? Why are you living in the future? Live in the now, because that's where you are. And I think that concept of Divinity being able to flip back and forth through, and these factions being opposed, it really shows and reinforces, in my mind, Kent's idea that the now, the moment you're in now, is what really matters. What do you think, Jesse?
No, I agree. I meet people, and you've met people. We all have met people that exist in both extremes. And I even find myself existing in the future all the time, thinking about what the next step is. I'm moving 3 and 4 steps down the road because I want to be ahead of the game and whatnot. But let's break that down for a second. It really, when you take it all together and follow the path, it leads you to the present. And I mean that in this sense. Why do I want to make good grades in high school? Well, I want to make good grades in high school so I can go to a good college. Why do I want to go to a good college? Well, because I want to get a good job. Well, why do I want to get a good job? Well, because I want to make money. And why do I want money? Well, I want to be comfortable and provide a good life and marry a beautiful woman. Okay, and why do I want to do that? Well, I want to be able to create a life in which case that I'm satisfied and I can have a present that I exist in, that I can feel accomplished and happy and have peace. So all the things I've done focused on the future really lead to the present. What happens in that is that I forget along the way to enjoy the present, because the present isn't some distant point in the future that, is an ultimate goal. The present is where you always are. So you could be happy and at peace at all times along the way and enjoy the journey, as opposed to being stressed out and competitive and focused along that journey the whole way to where you never enjoy it. You're never in peace. And by the time you do reach that destination in the future, you can't really enjoy it because, you've shaped your entire existence around the opposite of what it is that you've been seeking the entire time. So that's looking forward. And then the opposite of that is looking back, where, I've dated women in the past and had friends in the past that they're always talking about how great the past was, or how great, high school was, or college was, or back at that vacation they took 15 years ago. And I'm looking at them like, wow, right now is pretty good too. You could enjoy the moment, but they can't seem to do it because they're always looking back, And when you're looking back, you're not enjoying the moment. Plus, you're also not looking forward. So I think that the moral of the concept of this whole thing is that the moment is now. Now is time. Now is all that really matters. You've got to be aware of the future. You got to be aware of the past. You don't want to be moving blind, and you don't want to forget. But the past is a memory, and the future is a fantasy. The past is gone. The future hasn't happened. And so all you have is now, because now is real. Now can be touched. It can be felt. It can be lived and enjoyed. So, yeah, I'm apt to agree. The present. That's where it's at.
Yep, the present. That's where it's at. That would be like a great T-shirt. All right. I'm going to touch on this one really quickly because it's something that I think is explored in a lot of stories of today, and that's choosing side in the conflict. And again, this is one that's not as overt an idea in the story as some of the others, but I think that it's there. And it's just the idea that no matter what side you choose based on your viewpoint, you need to be open to the idea that you're wrong, and how sometimes life is not black and white, and choosing sides in a conflict isn't always as easy as a snap decision. And really, you should kind of take the time to do a little research, so to speak, to kind of really understand what each side of those is. And I really feel like today, even with things as ubiquitous and seemingly innocuous as social media, it's kind of important to know before you put it out there. I think too many people these days make snap decisions and snap judgments and choose a side, whether it's an actual physical conflict, a war, what have you, or just something as simple as Republican or Democrat, political ideas. And I think that people don't really take enough time to understand both sides before choosing. So again, it's a concept that's, as I said, much explored and much kind of in the headlines with the state of the world today. But it was kind of inevitable that it show up in the story just because of the concept that Jesse and I were just talking about, the different viewpoints of these factions within the unknown. Anything you want to mention about choosing sides, Jesse?
Yeah, it's important to note that the concepts of good and evil are really kind of just man-made. They're as we learned in Star Wars, it's all from a certain point of view. And something I've learned traveling the world is everybody I've ever met, whether I was in Iraq talking to the Iraqis, or and various parts of Southeast Asia and the South Pacific dealing with different groups and stuff, everybody thinks they're the good guy. Yet everybody is at odds with one another based on ideology, religion, or ultimate goals. And so it's difficult to label anybody per se as, evil or good. I mean, there are definitely evil people out there, don't get me wrong. But taking a side, oftentimes we find that we take sides just based off of where we previously were, what we identify with, rather than what may be truly better or worse, what may be perceived as evil or good. We take it as, this is who I am, this is where I'm from, so this is what I stand for. Or we take it as, oftentimes on social media, we'll just agree or disagree with something just because of, maybe patterns of thought or patterns of social patterns that we subscribe to, and then we'll bend and twist the facts to justify what we believe after the fact. So we're not, being, scientific about it. We're not always being very, very mature about it. We're not looking at the facts first and then saying, wow, this makes the most sense. Or, man, I'm glad I looked at the facts before I made this snap judgment or snap decision. We don't do that. We're actually not as bright as we think. We have a tendency to just say, hey, I identify this way. My friends identify this way. I think I'm supposed to identify this way. So I do identify this way on this particular issue. And, oh, look, these facts that I just found support how I believe, how I think. I guess I was right. When in reality, they were handpicked, cherry picked, and carefully selected, and don't really prove anything other than, just reassuring yourself, which is very dangerous because it's choosing a side very likely to be incorrect information that just is comforting, but not necessarily real or honest.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I think it goes back to just kind of doing your research, just take 30 seconds to Google something before you pick a side. All right. The next thing I wanted to talk about, and this one's one of the more overt ideas, especially in issue 3, I think it is, and that's the futility of violence. When Mishka and Divinity finally kind of understand what's going on with their child and are faced with the prospect of physically fighting, having a physical altercation for him, Divinity has this idea. He kind of tries to keep himself separate from the combat. And by that, I don't mean that he doesn't he physically removes himself. He just doesn't react. If somebody wants to grab him and throw him to the ground, they grab him and throw him to the ground. He doesn't really fight back. And you could think of it as kind of a weak stance, but really it's coming from a stance of strength. It's him standing up for what he believes in, because he really doesn't see the point of it. He says as much in the story. He says, what good ever comes from anger? What creation ever comes from violence? What beauty ever comes from anger? He just sees it all as so pointless. And it's interesting because we can see it ourselves as kind of a failure of humanity to not be able to resolve our conflicts without anger or frustration or the destruction of war. But really what Kent is saying is in this story is that, hey, that's not only a human problem. You know, here's these advanced beings who certainly are more powerful than we as a race are. And they're falling into the same traps of trying to solve their problems through violence. So again, it goes back to the idea that for whatever reason, Abram Adams really was the right kind of person, the right human who kind of had the best temperament to really have the powers bestowed on him that he does, because he's able to see that. He's able to recognize that. And a lesser person or a person with a different perspective wouldn't necessarily have that kind of idea. And I think this really harkens back to Divinity 2, as Jesse so eloquently recapped, with Mishka really finding her place and her happiness as being a part of the Soviet machine, and why she makes the decisions that she makes that lead to violence in Divinity 2, rather than Abram, who kind of steps back and says, no, this isn't the way that it should be done. And also going back to the way that Divinity solved that, as Jesse mentioned, he went back and solved it in the past by changing Mishka's past. She became a different person. She had different beliefs. She came around to his way of thinking that, yeah, compassion and understanding are really what we should strive for, not conflict and trying to solve problems through violence. What do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, I will say on this, on a certain level, I do believe that there are points in human history where violence is justified and necessary to a degree to achieve the greatest good for the greatest number of people. However, let's be honest here. I've watched so many movies and read so many books where there was a battle for the sake of having a battle. There was a war, a fight just for the sake of, many, many things get in the way of your objective. And you have to look at what your objective is. Divinity looks at what his is. His is to find his child. All right. And so from his perspective, being sidetracked or going on some tangent or walking off into some battle or getting involved in something, some civil war between, alien world, it's completely counterproductive to what his end goal is. It's not accomplishing his mission. If anything, it's wasting time. It's getting in the way. It's not productive to achieving his goal. And likewise, Bloodshot's goal is to get into a secret facility and snatch the computer chip. Well, having a big gun battle doesn't necessarily get you that computer chip, does it? And as a matter of fact, it makes it harder. It makes it less effective, less efficient. Getting in there quietly, getting it, getting out, and then moving on without anybody knowing you were ever there would seem to be much more effective, much more efficient. I think that people, while it's exciting to watch a fight, while it's exciting to watch a gun battle, they don't seem to always realize that it's not necessary. It's not always necessary. it's entirely possible and actually much more practical sometimes to explore alternate means to achieve that objective that are far more efficient and effective. Because one, it allows for the continuation of life without the destruction of it is rampant. And two, you got to remember that you have a goal in the end anyway. And if you're not achieving that goal, if your steps on the path to that goal are not achieving that goal, then you're wasting time and you're wasting energy. And you're certainly not making the world better. I mean, that may not be everybody's goal to make the world better, but, you know, it shouldn't be your goal to make it worse. Yeah, I'm have to agree. I see the plot points here, and it's hard to disagree with them. I can see myself in Divinity's shoes saying, what in the hell is going on and why? Don't you remember we're trying to get our kid? Why are we in the middle of this? You know?
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, in the story, when Divinity's thinking that, it follows again, because this is an idea that comes up and a concept that comes up throughout the story. But again, he's in the middle of the battle and it comes up again to his, you know, the forefront of his consciousness, and it's ideas as a unifying force and how differences are really learned. And Abram, you know, thinks back to his life and the way, you know, the path that eventually led him to becoming divinity. And again, he really thinks that ideas are where it's at. That's what's important. That's what matters. It's not, you know, necessarily the actions or, you know, the day-to-day struggle or trying to, you know, become successful, whatever your metric for measuring that is. Really what's important to us as a species is ideas. As a race, it's ideas and concepts and being able to share an understanding of those ideas. And that's what will bring us together. That's what's important. That's what will ensure that humanity is going to exist, maybe far beyond our physical, existence. And unfortunately, through human failing, you learn difference and difference is called out. And that's where conflict arises. Again, I think it's presented in the story, because of who Divinity is as a character, as the correct viewpoint, as the right kind of idea, so to speak. But going back to what I said about David Camp, it's interesting that Matt Kent threw Camp in there because it does show that, hey, maybe Abram, maybe Divinity's not 100% correct about this idea of ideas as a unifying force, because Abram is using concept and idea as really a way to create division and create stratification. You know, like, okay, I have better ideas than you, therefore I'm better than you, therefore I'm above you, therefore I should be able to judge you. But at the same time, that's also bringing in difference if you're judging and using idea as a metric for difference. So that one is, again, one of those ideas that's in the book that really bears thinking about long term. It's probably the one idea in the book that I could probably think about and ponder for years and not really ever come up with what I would consider a good answer or a definitive answer, because it in a way is so abstract and there's no way to really prove it one way or the other. What do you have to say about that, Jesse?
No, I'm gonna agree on you on that point. You know, again, he's not right and he's not wrong. And whenever you tell a story that has, it gives the reader the ability to look at multiple viewpoints, without, you know, forcing them down a path or another, you know, which they're all going to do anyway to a certain degree, but, you're still creating a more compelling story because, we don't all come from the same backgrounds. We don't come from the same religions. We don't have the same, you know, Myers-Briggs type mindset. We're different, and that's a real basic concept. But it's very complex when you're trying to understand that two people can see the same universe in very different ways, and they can both be right and both be wrong.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. So I've been going first with all these ideas. I want you to go first this time. So I think the next thing we wanted to touch on was, again, something that happened in the book that was very overt and talked about, and but also a very interesting concept. And I think one that a lot of people fall into these days, and that's prisons made of your own belief, whether those are actual physical prisons or just limitations you put on yourself.
So that was a very interesting plot point. There was I can't remember if it was issue 2 or issue 3 of Eternity, but essentially you have Mishka and Divinity, and they're trapped in a kind of a multidimensional time bizarro universe prison thingy. In which case, you know, they're standing there, they can't find their child. They're stuck here. They don't know exactly how to get out of it. And they feel trapped. They feel powerless. It stops them in their tracks. And essentially, and I'm not sure if he understood this when he did it, but Abram, he escapes. He escapes by just completely being unwilling to accept entrapment and failure in his mission and in his plan. And so he takes himself out of the prison. And after the fact, we discover that really the prison was nothing more than a prison of the mind. No one was trapped. They just believed that they were trapped. And by believing that they were trapped, they were trapped. And then we find that that reality quite true in life as well. You know, I know so many people that are that appear to be stuck in a financial situation, or appear to be stuck in a relationship, or appear to be stuck in a dead end job, or appear to be stuck with psychological issues or addictions or whatever it may be, and they're not really stuck. They may be delayed. They may have obstacles to overcome. They may have personal things that have to be addressed. But no one is stuck, beyond that which they allow themselves to be stuck. Now, there are, you know, true situations on this planet where there are some outside influences that are quite insurmountable, and I get that. And I'm not going to try to downplay that. But I am going to say flat out that, that we, many of us, myself included, have and exist in prisons of our own mind. And oftentimes we'll break down one wall or exit one cell of that prison of our own mind, only to find ourselves in a larger cell or a larger cell. And we may never truly exit all the cells. We may find ourselves just in a massively larger prison of our own mind with a little bit more roaming room, a little bit more free space. But the concept that it was presented in Eternity, even though it was only a couple pages, is a very real and very very pertinent to the world that we exist in and that many of us deal with. So I thought that was very very interesting, very thought provoking, as I would hope this discussion about it would be, because it is directly applicable, I would say, to every single one of us.
Yeah, I agree, and I think there's kind of a trap to fall in here where a lot of people are like, you know, that's Tony Robbins, you know, infomercial late night TV talk, you know, the power of positive thinking, and I can do anything if I just put my mind to it. And I would say to those that have that belief, yeah, there is something to that. You know, you can't just keep thinking positively every time you buy a lottery ticket and eventually you're going to win. We can't all win the lottery. It's just not possible, no matter how much you want to, you know, and karma, putting good things out of the universe and good things will happen back to you. It doesn't always work that way. But I would say that positive belief in yourself can go a long way. And that's really the way that Abram escapes the prison. As Jesse says, he refuses to accept it, right? And take it one step further than that. Not only does he refuse to accept that, he believes in his ability to overcome it. And so I think a lot of these obstacles that we kind of put in our way, a lot of the ones that Jesse mentioned, we feel like we can't overcome them. And that's the trap. That's the prison right there. I don't think I can overcome it. Rather than thinking, it's going to take hard work, but I know I can do it. And that's the other part of it. You've got to be willing to put in the work. You've got to be willing to take the step, whatever that step might be. For Abram, in this particular instance, escaping the prison was literally taking a leap of faith, literally jumping off the platform that him and Mishka were on, knowing that he could, no matter what obstacle or what was going to happen, that he could overcome it. So belief in himself and being willing to take the step and do the work or whatever it might be, and no matter how hard it might be. So yeah, very appropriate and very poignant in a way. And a lesson I think that we all can learn. The next concept, going back to the idea of violence, there's something that happens in the story, that it's kind of the way that David Camp reinserts himself into, the narrative. And it has to do with unintended, consequences. And, when you choose to use violence as a tool, how, you know, going back to what Divinity was saying earlier about how violence doesn't solve anything. And again, it's not that this action that David Camp took, that he intended for the negative consequences of that to occur. But when you choose to walk down that path, you're opening up that can of worms. And this is another one that I think it's a deep dive, and there's a lot to explore there. And I personally feel like I said enough about kind of the futility of violence before. So I'm going to let Jesse mention anything else that he wants to. But again, it's just Matt Kent, you know, putting this idea out there, presenting it that, hey, just remember that your reactions have reactions. And the more violent a reaction you have, it's probably going to engender, you know, a violent reaction. So you raise the stakes. So does, you know, the consequences, the reactionary equivalent of it is raised as well.
Yeah, violence is an interesting concept. It exists in the animal kingdom. It exists in human history. It's something that, you know, we have entire religions based on abstaining from. And yet we ourselves cannot necessarily avoid it always. And it comes in cycles, and almost every country, every civilization that exists in part because at some point violence was there, but it also exists because at some point violence was ceased, and then society was able to flourish. You know, we have, for example, Buddhism. If you look at Buddhism as a whole, that was supposed to be a very pacifist, very, very peaceful faith. But if you actually look and get deep into it, you start coming into situations where people, you know, monks would enslave people, or currently in Burma, where the monks, believe it or not, the Buddhist monks are killing the Muslims of all things. I mean, so even in faiths and ideologies where pacifism and abstinence of violence would seem to be the cornerstone, that fails too, because of course human beings, we fail. So I think what it ultimately comes down to is, I believe it was either Aristotle or Plato said, to be angry is easy, but to be angry in the right way and to the right degree at the right time and then at the right person or event, you know, and to the, you know, that is not easy. That is not. And as a paraphrase, it's not an exact quotation, but, the point is this. Anger and violence is part of the animal that humanity is. However, that's not to say that we should be mindless, violent beings. You know, things should be thought out. Things should be civilized. Things should be, explored. You know, not everything has to result in a death match. And when you do, you have to be prepared for an equal amount of force to come right back. And there's so many tragedies that we have seen, you know, where one guy used violence to, change his position in life only to have his position in life destroyed, or to defend the things that he loved only to have the things that he loved destroyed, or if not himself. There's an entire, you know, good Lord, academic field on the study of violence. And there's so many thousands of hours of discussion that could go into it. But I would simplify it by simply stating this. Violence should always be used sparingly and for the greater good, based on whatever perception of the greater good that your civilization or society at that time unified believes in. Because if it's haphazard and random and all over the place, it's going to lead to the opposite of the intended result, which is stepping back in the progress of moving forward.
Yeah, well said, Jesse. The next concept is life as a cycle, and this is really one of the big ideas that plays throughout the whole Divinity story, as well as the Eternity series. And with what happens at the end, you kind of wonder if Divinity and Mishka are starting that cycle all over again. And I feel like this really ties into the concept of living in the present. Because here's the thing, right? Like, if you can't break out of whatever cycle you're in, whether that be the cycle of life or the cycle of violence, you know, whatever label you want to put on it, then there's a tendency to kind of feel like the inevitability, to get back to that concept, or the futility of your choices and your actions. So why do anything if I can't break out of the cycle? But isn't that the point that we were getting to about living in the now? If life is a cycle as presented in this story, and things are to some extent, you know, predestined, you can't necessarily predict the future. You can't change the past. So what's the point of existing? What's the point of making choices? Well, the point is to find happiness in the now. Right? To find happiness with the people that are in your lives, and to do the things that you need to do to kind of maximize your positive impact and the meaningfulness of your life in the now, because that is what you can control. So again, it's a giant concept. It plays throughout the entire Divinity and an Eternity story, and I could talk about it, you know, for probably hours on end, really, but. Just something I want you to be aware of in the story, so you can kind of see it and explore it yourself and get more value out of the story. What do you think, Jesse?
I think you're spot on with that. We see towards the end of Eternity that despite, you know, the search for their child, despite what ultimately transpires and whatnot, despite the feelings of loss that exist or whatnot, we see them. Let's do this all over again, you know, essentially. And the cycle repeats. There's so many things that we could go into on this, but ultimately it comes down to this. The present is where it's at.
Yeah, definitely. And you do get to ask yourself the question too, like, okay, knowing what they know, they're still willing to kind of head down the path, you know, start around the circle again. And it really does show, in a way, kind of the resiliency of humanity and the, you know, the unbreakable human spirit, if you will. They're still willing to take that leap of faith and try for something more, you know, while living in the present. So an interesting idea as well. Last thing I'll mention is just the end ? Is what I put in the notes, just because we do see David Camp make almost a surprise reappearance at the end of the story. And so it's just the idea that maybe Matt Kent isn't finished with this narrative just yet, this corner of the Valiant universe. I hope he's not, because it's a fascinating corner, and it engenders a lot of thought. I don't know, with the current state of Valiant and their recent acquisition, if we will be able to get back to these stories, but I hope we do. What do you think about that? You ready to dive back into more stories in this corner, Jesse?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's a very easy answer. Matt Kent clearly has future plans for this series and this character, these characters. It's up in the air if that occurs or not, based on what you said with the recent acquisition of Valiant by DMG. I know that the plan was there. it's clear when you read the story. It's clear when you see everything laid out. I mean, you don't introduce all these characters. You don't introduce all these plot points. You don't leave these loose ends open without anticipating, you know, further exploration of that. And so time is going to tell. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the Valley universe that, I'm anxious to see where it goes. There's a lot of plot points. There's a lot of loose ends that, I know, not just myself, but, you know, the Valiant community and fans as a whole are waiting anxiously with fingers crossed to see where, how it plays out. And it's what keeps us coming back week after week, month after month.
Yeah, I totally agree. So one last thing I'm going to bring up, cause we've talked about this for, a long time, almost 90 minutes now, which is great. It goes to show how much there is in this story and how rich a world Matt Kent has created. Jesse and I, we're going to talk a little bit about the state of Valiant. We're going to save that for next time. But one thing that I want to ask Jesse, because I feel like maybe I missed something here. So I'm hoping to tap his knowledge myself, just like you listeners are hopefully tapping the knowledge of Jesse and myself both. And that's the robot story that's told within the pages. And it's basically a story told to us by Abram. He talks about this obscure science fiction story that he read as a kid. And I felt like personally, I don't know, maybe if I missed a point or something, but I didn't necessarily understand why the robot tells his creator what he says at the end. I didn't feel like there was really an underlying reason for it. You know, the robot is subjected to human violence and becomes very powerful because of it. And in the end, instead of choosing revenge, he says, I'm going to use all this energy to fix humanity. But I guess what I'm missing is I missed the motivation. I wonder what it was that made the robot make the choice that he did. Did I miss something there, Jesse?
You know, what I think is happening in that particular story is you have Abram paralleling himself to that story. He's basically giving his own motivations here. He wants to use all his powers for good, for bettering humanity, despite the fact that, you know, he was sent to space to die, despite the fact that, you know, he was on a failed mission, despite the fact that, you know, he has already waged wars and fought battles and altered the shape of humanity, time, space, and everything in between. You know, he has these powers of a god. He has this vast knowledge, intellect. He has this incredible amount of awareness on a level that far exceeds that of any human being, with outside of perhaps Harada. Actually, he surpasses Harada in many regards. You know, yet he still chooses the betterment of humanity. He still chooses to make the Earth and if not the universe, a better place. And so while it may be a little bit, confusing, you know, to match these two together, I really think that was the intended, purpose of that story. And I'd have to go back and read it a few times to dissect it even further. And I'm sure that if I did dissect it a little bit further, I would come to the same conclusion just with a few more talking points on it. But, I think that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to explain why he is and almost with a parable, of why he's doing what he's doing. Why he makes the choices that he makes.
All right, fair enough. I didn't catch that, I guess. I didn't see it as a parallel of divinity. Now that you say that, it seems obvious to me. I'm a little embarrassed that I missed it. But at the same time, I think that I still have that question, right? Like, so that, you know, the robot basically asked the maker, like, why did you do this? Why did you send me out? Why did you make me the way that you did? And the robot's creator says, well, I knew that you would survive it and you would basically take all the hate and violence directed against you and store it up as energy and become the most powerful being. So then you could exact your revenge. And the robot hugs the maker and says, no, there's too much work to do fixing humanity. Why would I break it? So again, I guess just the,
right. So
the motivation.
So let's think about that for a second. There's, I don't think that Abram knows why he was chosen by out there in the unknown. I don't know if he understands the purpose of why he why he was selected, or he knows that he was, and he knows, you know, the powers that he has, but the why. Wouldn't it be really, really, really interesting if, and I have no way that I'm just making this up as I go, but wouldn't it be interesting if the events that transpired from Book of Death, the death of Harbinger, in which case Toyo Harada goes out into space and merges his consciousness with Pete Stanchek, and they, you know, become pure energy and all this. Wouldn't that be interesting if it was actually Harada out there in a different time and reality that ultimately is the unknown, and his consciousness is and powers and energies are what goes into Abram, which makes him divinity, and then comes back. In which case, he would have been in years from now, if this were the plot device that comes out, the one who creates the robot that is divinity, to you know, return to Earth and do what Harada could not have. Of course, the Harada of the present wouldn't know this, but you know, time is not absolute and spins in cycles. It's interesting. We could find this out because we already know how Matt writes, how he puts these plot points in, and then, you know, yeah, years from now we'll come back and revisit him and say, oh, that's what he was talking about. It may very well be that. But that's just me going off on a tangent of what if.
Yeah, Matt's going to listen to this and be like, damn it, now I have to change my story idea. Jesse figured it out. Yeah, it's interesting. And
Sorry, Matt.
I think that you're 100% correct. It is divinity paralleling himself to this robot. And I think it's a tale really yet to be told, because as much as we've learned about divinity and followed his adventures and been able to do deep dive into all these concepts, I don't think it necessarily has been explored the why, as you mentioned. So what is it about Abram that makes him so special? I mean, we mentioned it earlier in this podcast about how, if David Camp had been the one to get the powers, it would be very different. And how in Divinity 2, it's the difference in perspective that Abram has that allows him to bring Mishka, to save Mishka, really, not to defeat her, but to save her through affecting her in the past. So again, there's a lot here. I really encourage you all to go and pick up Eternity if you haven't read it. If you have, pick it up, because it's a great presentation altogether as one story in this trade paperback. So go check it out. Incredible job by Matt Kent, Trevor Harrison, Ryan Wynn, David Barron, and Yelena on covers. It's incredible. I think there's so much there, as evidenced by the fact that Jesse and I have gone on and on about it for 90 minutes, and we really barely scratched the surface. We could, you know, sit around having a drink and talk about it for hours on end, no doubt. So I encourage you all to go in and check it out. Thank you, as always, for joining us on the podcast. Please go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. While you're there, be sure you check out all the other pop culture coverage, movies, TV shows, video games, all that kind of good stuff. Twitter.com/thecomicsource is where you can find The Comic Source on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those platforms. All three places are a great way to follow along with convention coverage, as well as to be notified when we release new episodes. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.